Chapter 15. At Sparks, Nevada, he bought tickets to Salt Lake City. They spent a few hours wandering around Sparks. It was close to Reno and very modern and well cared for. And then they were on their way across the Nevada desert. It was 3:30 in the morning. Both of them slept. There was nothing beyond the bus, no lights, no life. The bus roared along without stopping. When Al awoke, the sun had come up. He saw all around them the rocky lands, hills of broken rock, scrubby gray plants, and here and there along the road, discarded human debris. The time was 8:15. According to schedule, they were almost to the Utah border. At Wendover, the bus stopped so that they could get breakfast. This was the last stop in Nevada, the last gambling machines. The town lay along the highway, spread out with space between each house and shop, sandy soil on which nothing grew. To exercise their legs, he and Julie walked the length of the town and then back to a cafe for hot cakes and bacon.
"We could be almost anywhere in California," Julie said, looking around the cafe. "The same booths, the same cash register, jukebox."
The cafe seemed to have been newly built. Everything was freshly painted and stylish.
"The only thing different," she said, "is the newspaper and the funny-looking dirt outside."
Several other passengers were eating in the cafe, too, so they had no fear of being left.
"Are we going to stay in Salt Lake City?"
Julie asked. "Maybe," he said. It seemed to him as good a place to relocate themselves as any, at least from what he had heard of it.
"It's sort of exciting," Julie said. "An adventure like this, not knowing where we're going, just moving on, not stopping, cutting ourselves off from our past, our families."
She smiled at him. Her face was wan from lack of sleep, and her clothes were rumpled. His were the same, and he needed a shave. Suddenly, he had a premonition. Salt Lake City was too big a town. They would have a representative there. He said, "I think we'll go on as soon as we get to Salt Lake." Getting out the map, he examined the possibilities. A town small enough to be unimportant to the Harmon organization, but large enough so that he could get a job or go into business, open a used car lot, he thought. There would be enough money, just barely enough, if he bought wisely.
"I'd like to see Salt Lake City," Julie said. "I've always wanted to."
"So would I," he said.
"But we can't," she studied him.
"No," he said.
"I have no say-so in this,"
he said. "You better let me decide." Julie went on eating then. So he did too. After they had left the cafe, they walked slowly back in the direction of the parked Greyhound bus. They could see the driver. He was off talking to two middle-aged women, so they did not hurry.
"This is a very pretty little town," Julie said. "But there's nothing doing here. We've seen it all. It's just a place for people to stop and eat and get their cars fixed and do a little last gambling."
Turning towards him, she said,
"Do you feel safer here?"
"Probably not."
"You'll never feel safe. It's really inside you."
"What is?" he said.
"The conflict, the thing you're running away from. Psychologists say we carry our problems with us,"
he said. "Maybe so." He did not feel like arguing with her. They came to the bus. The door was open, and he started to ascend the metal steps.
"I don't believe I'll get on," Julie said.
"Okay," he said, stepping back to the ground.
"At all."
She did not flinch. She met his gaze.
"I've decided I don't want to go any farther. I think there's something you're not facing in yourself, that you've never faced. And you're dragging me along. If you try to force me to get on the bus, I'll scream and they'll stop you. I see a highway patrolman or somebody over there."
She nodded her head. He saw the parked patrol car with its antenna. "You going to stay in Wendover?" he said in agony.
"No. I'm going to take the next bus back to Reno, and I'm going to stay there a few days and do some shopping. And then if I like it there, I'll stay there and get a Nevada divorce. And, of course, get a job there. And if I don't like it, I'll go on back to Oakland and get a California divorce.
On what?
Won't you give me part of the money?
He was silent. Other passengers, seeing them at the bus, were beginning to come, afraid they might be left behind. The driver was winding up his conversation with the middle-aged woman.
I want you to come back with me, Julie said. But probably you won't. You'll go on fleeing.
He groaned.
Yes, she said. Groan, because you know it's the truth.
He said, it's crap.
Just give me some of the money, not even half. Just say $500. I know how much there is. That leaves you almost $1,500. Under California joint property law, half of it is mine. But I don't care. I just want to end this pathology, this...
She broke off. Other people were going by them and up into the bus. Al said, I'll have to sign the traveler's check so they won't be good.
Fine, she said.
Holding the checks up against the side of the bus, he signed $500 worth. He gave them to his wife.
Well, she said quietly, you did just give me $500. I thought maybe you'd volunteer half.
Well, it doesn't matter. Tears filled her eyes, and then she turned to the driver who had come up and said,
I'd like my luggage. I'm not going on. May I, please?
She held out the claim check. The driver glanced at her, then at Al, and then accepted the claim check. Al got onto the bus and reseated himself, alone. Below, on the outside, the driver was unloading Julie's suitcase. He slammed the metal door shut after the suitcase and then hurried up into the bus to seat himself at the wheel. A moment later, the motor roared on. Gray smoke poured from the exhaust. The remaining passengers got quickly on and found their seats. Seated in the bus, Al saw his wife walk away with her suitcase into the bus depot. The door closed after her, and then the doors of the bus shut and the bus began to move. He felt the rift, the ghastly, purposeless rift. What did it matter now whether he went on or not? But he was going on. He was on his way, alone, to Salt Lake City, and whatever came after that. Maybe this is better, he thought, for us to separate. At least they won't get both of us. It was hopeless from the start to try to make her go along. He thought, you can't force people to do anything. I can't make Julie do what I want her to do, any more than Lydia Ferguson could force me to send flowers or go to the mortuary. Each of us has his own life to live out, for better or worse.
The Great Salt Lake was enormously hot, white, and unsteady. Toward midday, the bus had crossed it and had reached the fertile green part of Utah with trees and small lakes. Once more, he saw countryside, not much different from California. There was quite a bit of traffic on the highway. He saw ahead the beginnings of a large city. He found Salt Lake City as crowded and busy and built up as the Bay Area. It, like Oakland, had other smaller cities so close to it that they merged. Residential and business districts, he thought as he gazed out the bus window, were about the same everywhere. Motels, drug stores, gas stations, cleaning establishments, dime stores. The houses seemed to be mostly of brick or stone, or, if of wood, unusually substantial. The streets were well-maintained and noisy. He saw a lot of teenagers and their cars, the modified hot rods that he saw all day long going back and forth along San Pablo Avenue. In many ways, he decided, Salt Lake City appeared to be an ideal town for a used car business. Everyone seemed to drive, and there were plenty of older cars to be seen. When he got off the bus in downtown Salt Lake City, two plainclothes policemen took hold of him and led him off to one side of the depot. Are you Alan Miller of Oakland, California? One of them asked him, showing his badge. He was so completely cut down that he nodded, yes. We have a warrant for your arrest, the plainclothes policeman said, showing him a folded paper, and return to the state of California. They began to move him between them toward the curb in their parked police car. What for? Al demanded. For fraud, one of them said as they pushed him into the car. Obtaining money under false pretenses. What money? He demanded. Who says so? The litigant signing the complaint in the county of Alameda, California, Mrs. Lydia Ferguson. The policeman started up the car, and they drove off into downtown Salt Lake City traffic. Meanwhile, in the back of the car, the other policeman was searching Al. He offered no resistance. You'll be here a couple of days, and then you'll be on your way back. Al could think of nothing to say. You know this Mrs. Ferguson? One of the policemen said to him with a wink at the other. Sure, Al said. After a time, one of the policemen said, Is she a widow? Al said, Yes. Fat? Middle-aged? Al said nothing. What's your stated occupation? One of the policemen said. Car salesman, Al said. You've gone up in the world, the policeman said and chuckled. Transportation arrangements were made the next day. With another male prisoner of the state of Utah, he was sent back to California in the custody of a sheriff's deputy. They made the trip by air, and within a few hours after leaving Salt Lake City Airport, they were landing at the Oakland Airport. There, a police car met them, and they were taken to the Oakland Hall of Justice. Only 2.5 days had passed since he and Julie had started on their trip. I wonder where she is, Al thought as he sat on a bench in one of the courtrooms waiting to be arraigned. Did she go back to Reno? Is she there now? Strange, he thought, to be back here. He had never expected to see Oakland again. Through a window of the courtroom, he could make out the public buildings of Alameda County, and somewhere, not far out of sight, would be Lake Merritt, where many times he had gone canoeing. Coming back by air made the distance seem short. I didn't get very far, he decided. A few hours away, that's all, for those who travel by air. It had never occurred to him to take a plane. That must be the kind of thing Lydia meant, he thought, when she said, I understood the world so little. Someone, evidently an employee of the court, came over and told him he should have an attorney. Okay, he said. The whole thing seemed vague to him. I will. You want a phone? Maybe later, Al said. He could not think of anyone to phone. He wished that he had his pills with him. Perhaps he did. He began fishing in his pockets, but without success. No, he realized, the anisin tin was in another pair of pants, or the police had taken it away. They had gone over all his things. Maybe that's what happened to me, he thought. Somehow I got cut off from my pills. The next he knew, a short, bald, foreign-looking man in a double-breasted suit had come into the courtroom. I know him, Al said to himself. Maybe he's my lawyer. But then he remembered him. It was Lydia's lawyer, whatever his name was. Several people conferred with the lawyer, and then Al found himself being moved out of the courtroom down a hallway. I'm really in their hands, he said to himself. They guide me around wherever they want. A policeman pointed to an open door, and Al entered a side room, a sort of office with chairs and a table. Thanks, he said to the policeman, but the policeman had already gone. The door opened, and Lydia's short, bald foreign lawyer entered with his briefcase. Moving rapidly, in an important manner, he seated himself facing Al and unzipped his briefcase. For a moment he glanced over papers and then he looked up. He smiled.
They all smile, Al thought. Maybe that's how you can tell them. I'm Boris Tsarnas, the lawyer said. We have met.
Yeah, Al said.
Mrs. Ferguson didn't want to see you, at least at this time. I'm her counsel, you understand, in this matter. His voice dropped to a drone. As well as other matters involving the estate of her deceased husband and so forth.
He studied Al for so long that Al became uncomfortable. The man had bright, intelligent eyes, small as they were.
The investment, Tsarnas said, was perfectly reputable.
That was it, then.
That explained it, Al nodded. We had all the financial records, all the statements from the accountants gone over. The net return on her investment will probably be very high, at least 10%, possibly more, possibly as high as 12. Harmon was acting without any recompense. He has no involvement with the enterprise, save that he knows Mr. Bradford and the deceased Mr. Ferguson. It appears that he was doing precisely as he indicated, offering his informed guidance in securing for the deceased a premium investment which now becomes advantageous to the heir, Mrs. Ferguson. And so I have advised her.
He snapped his briefcase shut. In a friendly manner, he said, I thought you would be interested in knowing. You seem to have some concern over Mr. Harmon's reliability. When the check in question was stopped at Mrs. Ferguson's insistence, Mr. Harmon proceeded to make good on it himself.
That is, he advanced $41,000 of his own money to Mr. Bradford to cover the sum until such time as the check would be made good. So he risked a good deal of his own cash, to be sure. The investment opportunity was secured, and therefore not lost to the widow of the deceased.
Presently, Al said, Lydia knows all this?
As soon as we had gone over the financial statements, we so informed her. This Marin Gardens place is well thought of in Marin County real estate investment circles. A number of sanguine people on the other side of the bay, and a few here, have bought in.
Al said, What's that got to do with her having me arrested?
You obtained a large sum from Mrs. Ferguson under false pretenses. You alleged that while working to protect her interest, you encountered a severe loss, and you intimated that she was responsible and so should make good.
As soon as she told me what she had done, I advised her to start action to stop that check. The man's eyes danced.
But of course you put it right through. Mrs. Ferguson then wished me to advise her concerning further action. You had, as we discovered, left California as soon as you had cashed the check.
His smile grew. The bank informed us that you had converted the $2,000 into traveler's checks, and we found that both you and your wife had packed and left together. In fact, she had packed while you cashed the check. He continued to smile at Al, almost as if he admired him.
I sold her a car, Al said. A 30-year-old car, completely in ruins, worth no more than a few dollars as scrap.
It was true, he had to admit it.
But they wrecked the car, he said.
Who? Tsarnas' eyes blazed up briefly.
Harmon and his goons. Nonsense. Yes, you told her that. The Oakland police have the vandals. The car was wrecked even before Mr. Ferguson's death by some kids who've been vandalizing property up and down West Oakland for months.
Huh? Juveniles, Al murmured.
Yes, Tsarnas said.
Al said, Harmon got my wife fired.
Your wife? Wasn't fired, Tsarnas said.
Al stared at him.
If it's important to establish this, and I don't see why it is, we, that is, the Harmon organization, checked with your wife's employer. She quit, sir. She said that her husband now had a decent job, and she had been wanting to quit for some time. It was not unexpected. They had no idea where she or you might have gone. She simply quit and left the office. Her check is being mailed to her. She didn't even wait to pick it up.
The lawyer studied Al.
You were interested in Ferguson's money, I take it. The accrual from the sale of his garage. Or was it a grudge because he sold his garage? Why did you go to so much trouble to bilk Mrs. Ferguson, deceiving her regarding the investment arranged through Mr. Harmon, and then settle for $2,000 instead of the...
I have nothing to say, Al said. Somewhere he remembered that statement. It seemed to be right. It seemed to be what he wanted. Considering, Tsarnas at length said,
Mrs. Ferguson is interested in having her money restored to her, not in persecuting you. Do you have the money?
Most of it, Al said.
It can be arranged, Tsarnas said, that if you make full restitution, no charges will be pressed. There are innumerable expenses connected with your arrest in Utah and your return here. Probably something would have to be worked out with both sides. I don't know. Anyhow, if you are willing and able...
I am, Al said. Willing and able. I can sell my lot and the rest of my cars to get the money.
You have no record?
Tsarnas said. No history of bunco stuff of this kind? No history at all, Al said.
Were you working alone? Tsarnas said. I'm just curious. I know Mrs. Ferguson had great fondness and admiration for you, up to the moment she realized, and don't imagine she wanted to realize, that you had bilked her out of $2,000. My Lord, didn't you work with her husband for a number of years?
Yes, Al said. I worked with her husband a number of years.
You really must have been nursing a long-term grudge, Tsarnas said, to become so active so soon after his death. That man was just cremated.
How was the service? Al said.
I didn't have the opportunity to be present.
Suddenly Al realized that he still had the $5 that Lydia had given him to buy flowers. It was still in his shirt pocket. He got it out and held it between his hands. He had bilked her out of this, too. So he handed it over to the lawyer. This belongs to Lydia, he said. The lawyer put it in his briefcase, in an envelope. How did you know which way I went? Al said.
How did you know I headed for Utah? You were cashing those traveler's checks all along the route, every time you stopped to eat, and you paid for your ticket at the Sparks Greyhound ticket office with a traveler's check. There was a bulletin out just after that, and they got in touch with the police.
Al said, What about my wife?
She got in touch with us, Tsarnas said, from Reno. She had noticed that you were acting erratically, and she feared to travel any farther with you. So, under a pretext, she disembarked at some small town along the way. Wendover.
Of course I was acting erratically, Al said. Everyone was against me. Plotting to kill me.
So she probably is back here by now, Tsarnas said half to himself as he rose to his feet. She felt you needed psychiatric aid. Possibly you do. If I were your attorney, I'd advise you to place yourself under county or state medical care. You certainly could obtain it. And private care is frightfully expensive.
Harmon's after me, Al said. He's brought everyone else into it on his side. I'm surrounded. That's why I had to leave the state.
Eyeing him, Tsarnas said, You might consider this. Mr. Harmon has an airtight case he could bring into court against you if he really wanted to hound you, as you seem to believe. Defamation of character, inasmuch as you accused him before witnesses of being a criminal, a swindler. and it can be shown that it damaged him in a financial way. It affected his business interests, did it not? Who'd I say that in front of? At the Harmon house, he had said nothing against Harmon. He was sure of it. Who's the witness? The old man who had heard him say that was dead.
Sarna said,
Mrs. Ferguson.
It was true. He nodded.
I have no reason to believe he contemplates any civil action against you, Sarna said. I'm only pointing it out in order to bring you to your senses, so perhaps you can be made to listen to reason.
I'm listening to reason, Al said, all the time.
Did the grief and shock of Ferguson's death temporarily drive you to derangement?
Sarna said.
Under the emotional pressure, did you lose the ability to distinguish what you were doing from a moral standpoint?
Well, it doesn't matter. If you behave yourself and keep your head, you won't be coming up before the judge anyhow. He nodded goodbye to Al and left the room. The door shut after him. An hour later, Al was told that he could go. He left the Hall of Justice and stood outside on the sidewalk, his hands in the pockets of his cloth jacket. They really gave me a demonstration, he said to himself as he watched the people and traffic going by, the heavy downtown Oakland traffic with its buses and taxis. They showed me they could whip me back here any time they wanted, and they could tell it their way, make their account of it work, and demolish mine. The same way they demolished my Marmon. And he realized they got everyone in it, even my wife. Although he realized she doesn't know and never will know. Who does know? He asked himself. Lydia Ferguson? Probably not. That lawyer? Too shrewd. I'll never be able to tell about him one way or another, if he believes it or if he knows it's nothing but a mass of interlocking and carefully polished shit. The police? They don't care. They're just a machine that does what the wires make it do. Like a vacuum cleaner that sweeps up whatever's in front of it and whatever's small enough. Harmon knows, he said to himself. That, perhaps, is the only one I can be certain of. Not Bob Ross, for sure, not Knight, not Gam, or any of them working for Harmon, not even Mrs. Harmon. But Chris Harmon himself, that's the difference between him and the rest of us. He knows what's going on. He knows what makes the thing run. And, Al thought, I know. Hands in his pockets, he walked over to the bus stop to wait for a bus that would take him uptown to his apartment. They prey on the weak, he said to himself. That is, the sick, such as the old man, the helpless, such as me, the widows, such as Lydia Ferguson. And they have us. There's no way we can fight back, because the language itself works against us. The very words were manufactured to explain their situation so it looks good, and ours so it looks bad. Looks so bad, in fact, that we're relieved to be let out of jail. We're relieved to be allowed to walk the street. He thought, I guess they'll let me go back into the used car business, where I was. I wasn't offending anyone there. I was in my place, the way Tootie Doolittle is in his place. But the difference between me and Tootie, he realized, is that Tootie knew the boundary. He knew how far he could go before he was stepped on, and I didn't. I thought if I used all the words, the same type of talk as Harmon and Ross and Knight and Gam and the rest of them, I could make it too. As if the only thing that separated me from them was the talk. The Yellow Key System bus came. Along with the other people at the stop, he pushed onto it. The doors wheezed shut and the bus started up. He was on his way back to his apartment in the three-story building where the McKechnies and the young Mexican couple lived, where he had begun his effort, his life of lies and crimes. I wonder if Julie is home, he asked himself. He did not feel like coming home to an empty apartment.